A full reopening with restrictions is the new normal, says Varadkar, but nighttime industry attacks chaotic guidelines. That's a headline on the front of the Irish Daily Mail, which, in common with all of today's papers in the Republic, leads with yesterday's announcement regarding which restrictions will be lifted and which will stay in place. The confusion surrounding how the reopening of nightclubs and other hospitality venues will work with restrictions in place dominates much of this morning's coverage. The Irish Daily Star and Irish Sun opt for the light-hearted headline, copper face masks and party on, with both papers report on the confusion which has been caused by the new rules. The Star observes how people can dance in nightclubs but not in pubs, while the Sun draws attention to the fact that the government gave the okay to mask-free dancing in clubs yet banned queuing at the bar for a drink. Under the headline, Nights of Chaos Ahead, the lead story in the Irish Examiner quotes Cork pub owner Ger Kiley describing the government's decision that all gigs in pubs must be seated as nonsensical. He says that the measure will halve the capacity at gigs in his venues, many of which have already been sold at full capacity. The decision, meanwhile, that sports fans will be allowed to fill stadiums generates the lead headline in the Irish Daily Mirror. The Irish Independent is more considered in its response to yesterday's announcement. Long winter of COVID rules despite our new freedoms is the headline on its front page, while the lead editorial inside today's paper urges everyone to comply with the new measures, recognising how our health officials and political leaders do not glory in these sanctions but have chosen them as the best possible route forward. For its lead story, meanwhile, the Irish Times details how the rollout of booster vaccines to the over 60s is due to start in November. Elsewhere on the front pages for its lead story, the Irish News reports that former RUC officer Brian Coulter, who was found dead at a house in Maher Felt in County Derry on Monday, had been convicted of the sectarian abuse of his neighbours 5 years ago. A man was later arrested in connection with his murder. Another killing, that of 23-year-old Jake Bailey Sloan, who died in hospital on Monday after being assaulted in Portadown in County Armagh on Sunday, is covered on the front of today's Belfast Telegraph. Police officers have arrested a man in his 20s and are treating the incident as a murder investigation. The Independent gives front page coverage this morning to a study conducted by UCC's School of Medicine, which is also carried inside today's Examiner, which found that an unacceptably high number of inter-county hurlers suspected of having sustained concussion during a game are allowed to resume play without adequate assessment. And finally, The Times and Independent both run with pictures on their front pages this morning of 18-year-old Emma Slevin from Galway, the first Irish gymnast to qualify for the all-around finals of the World Gymnastics Championship. She's pictured in action in Japan yesterday in both papers, and in each of those images, Emma is airborne.
So the country has taken another step, albeit a hesitant one, on the road to recovery with the announcement that from Friday some COVID restrictions will be eased. However, with the number of infections on the rise, mask wearing and the use of vaccination certificates will remain with us. Over the next few days on Morning Ireland, we'll be reporting on how places have been bouncing back or not, and on how the health system is coping or not. We're going to start this morning here in Drogheda in County Louth. We're in the Mill Enterprise Centre, a co-working centre for start-up businesses. Shortly we'll be getting political reaction to the latest announcements, but we're going to talk first of all to Dr. Ian Coonahan. He's a respiratory consultant and clinical director at the Department of Medicine at Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital here in Drogheda. Thanks very much for joining us this morning. You're also the hospital's COVID lead. What's the current situation?
Good morning, Rachel, and thanks for asking me to come on. I guess the current situation is the hospital's entering into its busiest time of the year. And at the moment, we've 23 patients admitted with COVID-related illness. So that represents 10% of the medical beds within the hospital. And, you know, this is a time of year with increasing normal respiratory illnesses where we tend to overflow those beds already into the surgical wards, sometimes the gynecology wards. And it's concerning that we're taking up essentially what is a large medical ward just purely with COVID. So it's very busy in the hospital at the moment. We have large presentations to the emergency department on a daily basis. I think August overall was the busiest hospital for unscheduled care that we've ever had.
Really? Why was that, do you think?
Well, I think we've just had, you know, so a year and a half of people mm-hmm. having poor access to the healthcare that they've been looking for. They've possibly tended to migrate towards the emergency department where, you know, when they're not able to get what they need or unwell and need acute attention. We've also, I think you've seen, obviously in the media last week, about the presentations of children within the hospital, and we've a paediatric emergency department. So that's been incredibly busy in the last number of weeks as well.
And typically now, the non-COVID patients, what are they coming to you with?
Well, they're coming in with the usual medical complaints, so people who are older and frailer with minor medical illnesses maybe, but that knock them off their baseline where they're not able to look after themselves at home, or their family aren't able to look after them at home because they've got a decompensation of a chronic condition mm-hmm. or an infection on top of their other comorbidities and frailty. And the usual respiratory illnesses, people coming in with pneumonias, flare-ups of their asthma, COPD, that's what I tend to see. People present with, you know, unfortunately, you know, bad illnesses like cancers and things as well throughout the year. So the usual things.
I gather you've had a case of flu. And I think last year, didn't we have a winter almost entirely without flu? But this year, there are early signs that it's out there.
Yeah, well, I just got notified, yeah, that our first laboratory positive case of influenza this week, I think it was 2 days ago. And so that really is a concern, because I guess while we've seen an uptick in the ordinary viruses such as RSV, particularly within children, and maybe a little bit earlier than usual this year, we are kind of I've been hoping that there wouldn't be as big a flu season this year and that maybe we'd get away with it again. But I think it just highlights how important it will be for people to get the influenza vaccination, particularly people who thought maybe they didn't benefit from it last year. I think this year it's going to be really important to get that.
Is there a danger? I mean, you're obviously very busy already, and we're very early on in the winter season. Is there a danger that all of this is going to have a knock-on effect and that operations will have to be cancelled?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that there's always a risk. I mean, we work in, as I say, we tend to become just overflow during the winter months, typically with medical admissions and people ending up spending more time in the emergency department and the patient experience time extending during that time, having to flow into surgical beds. You know, we've been fortunate enough to have a colleague join us from the NHS. He's worked in the NHS for the last 10 years, and he was meeting me as clinical director and asking me, you know, where's the space that we open the beds for the winter months for the additional capacity, you know, because that's the norm. But that's just not something that we have access to.
Yeah. So how have the past 18 months affected the hospital? I mean, it's been pretty much non-stop, hasn't it?
It's been busy, and I think we're getting to a time where the people that have, you know, really, you know, dived into this and just worked through it and given their all to it are getting really burnt out, you know, particularly over the summer months. I've seen that. I think we've noticed within the hospital that when we get a big upsurge in, you know, COVID cases where our ICU is full and we're working at a ward level with patients who really we would prefer to have in an ICU or HDU environment, that it takes a huge toll on the nurses and doctors and other health and social care professionals looking after them. I think on our respiratory ward, after this wave at the beginning of the year between March and July, we saw 24% of our staff nurses move on. So
what, they just had enough?
So I guess there'll be a natural turnover within any ward, but it's been the highest turnover of any ward within the hospital. So that just shows the toll that it's taking on those staff, because we've been really fortunate to have excellent nursing staff, you know, throughout the hospital, but the ones that I've been working with over the last 18 months, I've been really proud of. And so it's sad to see them feel that they need to move to other jobs, and I'm sure that's related to the stress and the toll that it's taken on them.
Dr. Ian Cunahan, COVID lead at Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital here in Drogheda, thank you very much for joining us here this morning. Also joining us is local TD Jed Nash, who's the Labour Party spokesman on finance, public expenditure and reform. Can we talk for a moment about yesterday's announcement? The Taoiseach has conceded that there are anomalies in what was announced. Is there anything that you think they got completely wrong?
I think there were a few things that they got right. I don't think anybody would have expected anything differently necessarily from the announcements that were made yesterday. The ground was being prepared for the very cautious unlifting of some restrictions and the remaining in place of some. And we understand why those restrictions would remain in place given the outline that Ian has explained, the context around which he is operating in Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital and the staff, and we should always prioritise our health service. There were some serious anomalies in what was announced yesterday, particularly as it relates to pubs and nightclubs. I've taken the time yesterday to canvass opinion from local nightclub owners and managers and publicans. Publicans are generally happy that they can continue to trade, albeit, yes, with some restrictions, and they understand why those restrictions would remain, but I think some clarity is required in terms of how nightclubs will operate safely, and indeed there's some disappointment in the live music sector in terms of some of the imposition of some of the restrictions that will remain on them. There's some good things I think that came out of yesterday's announcement. One was, for example, the rather belated conversion to antigen testing. Alan Kelly has made the case over the last 12 months for the more widespread use of antigen testing, and in fact there were companies in this very location who were in contact with me earlier this year looking to get involved in a pilot process that the Taoiseach announced that doesn't seem to have gone anywhere.
Can you understand, though, why the government has been slow on this, in that they always say they take their advice from NPHET, and it's NPHET who has been reluctant to see the wider introduction of antigen testing?
Yeah, and now that we've got actually a very extensive cohort of our population, 90%, in fact, the vast majority of our population vaccinated, I think there is a utility for antigen testing, and that could be applied potentially in other workplaces. I noticed that the Taoiseach yesterday announced that it will be spring before there's an en masse return to offices. And that concerns me because I get calls all of the time from people, for example, about the, you know, their right to request the ability to work from home. There is no legal framework at the moment to allow those to work from home. You can request it, but there's a power imbalance between you and your employer, and you're not really in a position to refuse. And I've dealt with cases in this area, an area where we have 10,000 people leaving the Drogheda and East Meath area every day to go to work in Dublin, and in some cases in Dundalk, looking to see when this legal framework will be introduced. And I think it's really important that legal framework now is expedited. We introduced a bill last year, 11 months ago on the Dáil. It went out for public consultation. The Taoiseach announced in the summer that legislation would be introduced within the year. We've yet to see that.
How have the past 18 months affected this area, would you say?
It's been difficult for individuals. Dr. Cunahan has outlined the stresses on staff in Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital. Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital is the biggest employer in this area, and we really value it. And I've seen at close hand myself the stress that staff have experienced because of the great work that they do, the really tremendous work that they do, and the pressure that they are under. What we have noticed, because this area is very much a hub for commuting, is that the area itself became much more lively during the day. Local businesses, in fact, were doing better. Coffee shops and so on, or takeaway coffees. People were starting to become a little bit more engaged in the community because they had the time. They had a better work-life balance. I think that return to the office, while some people want to do that, it is concerning some. And they'd like to see that legal framework within which they could operate to have some clarity around when they can work from home and how they can request that working from home situation and how they could be better protected.
All right, Jed Nash, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Jed Nash was talking there about the live music industry and the questions that they have following yesterday's announcements. Well, we can talk to Dave Parle. He runs Hidden Agenda Promotions, which books live performers. He also runs a small venue called The Big Romance in Dublin. He joins us now. Dave, thanks for being with us. Do you have gigs ready to go on Friday night?
How you doing, Audrey? Yes. We have a club event for Friday, which it looks like it's allowed to go ahead. But We're still figuring out some of the actual mechanics of actually operating a club show.
Okay, and why do you think that can go ahead? Is it because it's in a nightclub?
Exactly, yeah. But the phrase about there being some anomalies by Micheál Martin, I think, is probably an understatement. I think in practicality, there's a plethora of anomalies at the minute that we're experiencing, you know, because, for example, I have a show on Friday week, and it's a live show, but it's 9 p.m. doors and it goes till 3 a.m. So it's kind of in a club setting. And I have no idea right now if that's allowed within the current guidelines.
Yeah, because it's not clear whether if the live music is playing in a nightclub, people can get up and dance as normal. But if it's in another music venue, they can't.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So what we're experiencing right now is that it looks like shows this weekend that are in live venues that have sold to full capacity are not allowed to happen. But what if those shows happen at 11 p.m. and go on late? So there are venues in all over the country that do have a late license. They could go till 3 a.m. And often how those venues would function is they would have a gig at 8 p.m. that would finish at around 11, and then they would move into their club setting. So what we're trying to wrap our head around is, are we saying that those 8 p.m. gigs can't happen, but if the band played later at night during the late license section of the evening, is that allowed to proceed as normal with a dance floor?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of questions, there's lots of confusion within all of that. And there were vague indications from government yesterday of perhaps flexibility on this once these talks get underway today between the department and those involved in the industry. Are you planning on cancelling anything at this stage, or are you just going to wait and see what happens?
At the minute, it is wait and see. I've had a few agents and managers on to me, and I couldn't give them a straight answer. So it is about absorbing the information, talking to people in the industry, seeing if there's a follow-up release of guidelines today based on the feedback. It is really, really last minute, and again, that is very stressful for everyone in the industry, from promoters to the managers and stuff I mentioned, to the artists themselves who have been waiting a long time to get back out there.
Absolutely. Well, look, we wish you well, Dave, for what that's worth. Thank you very much, Dave Parle there, who runs Hidden Agenda Promotions. Well, the full return to offices, we're told, is being delayed until next spring in response to the rising COVID cases. That's according to the Tánaiste. A staggered return to the office was still possible, he said, but a full return wouldn't happen until spring 2022. We're joined now by Mary Connaughton, Director of the Chartered Institute of Personnel and Development. And Mary, does that tally with what's actually happening on the ground?
Well, I think for a number of organisations, yesterday's announcement means that they're going to have to push out their return to office plans until at least February. But for a number of companies, they didn't know, without knowing what was happening on the physical distancing front, they didn't know whether or not they had the space to bring people back. Now, quite a number of employers had already decided to push out their reopening timeline, mainly because they couldn't deal with the uncertainty of not knowing when or whether they could open, but also to show a more cautious and careful approach around managing the pandemic, and to help like both employees and customers understand what the business was doing. So now I suppose we're waiting on the work safety protocol, which will give more advice around that. But this, for many organisations, is a transitionary phase. So trying to reintroduce people back to the workplace, because that workplace has changed quite a lot, with new measures, new entrances, new ways to manage common areas. And also there's a lot more people who have joined the organisation who've never been on site. So we're encouraging people to look at this as a transitionary phase, work out what the balance of future smart working is going to be between people needing to be on site and people needing to be at home, and to treat it like an induction.
Is there a question, Mary, of liability on the part of the employer if, for example, an employee has come back to work over the last number of, come back to the office, I beg your pardon, over the last number of weeks, and they want to return to work from home because of the rising COVID cases, but they've been refused, and then if COVID is contracted at work?
In the main, what the rules around returning to work have been to do it on a staggered and as necessary basis. The reality is that with a virus out there, employees are at risk both in their personal lives and in their work lives of getting the virus. But we don't have many instances of it turning up in workplaces, thankfully. So it's not necessarily that the employer is liable, but we would be encouraging employers to let people who want to work from home work from home. And there are concerns around travel and transport. It's difficult to manage care arrangements when it's unpredictable. And overall, we think, you know, people should need a clear purpose to come to the office. It's not a matter of everyone in or everyone out, but try and organise people had to have some time in the office and some time at home.
Are you hearing examples of employees being pressured to return to the workplace?
We know there are examples out there where, based on the nature of the work and particular work activities, that people are being asked to come in for that. And some organisations did, as part of their staggered return, try to bring in people, say, 2 days a week and or 3 days a week. So they have been trying that out. So it is happening out there. But more and more what we're hearing is employees, you know, who've been very productive while they have been working from home are saying, why do we need to be in the office? One thing we're conscious of, particularly at this time of the year, is that well-being is an important agenda. And we have found out over the pandemic that that's really more difficult to manage in a virtual workspace. So that social connection and meeting people in the workplace and that collaboration is important. So we do think bringing people back on a phased basis for that sort of activity is important. But otherwise, individual activities should be left to be carried out individually at home.
OK, thank you very much, Mary, for talking to us. Mary Connaughton, Director of CIP. Ireland.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. Discover our 2-to-1 offers at your local Kia dealer. For more, log on to kia.com.
It's 7:37 on Morning Ireland, and Des Cahill's here. Morning, Des.
Yeah, morning, Audrey. We're going to start with the drama and some big individual performances in last night's Champions League action. Mo Salah scored twice for Liverpool. They had a 3-2 win away to Atletico Madrid, an action-packed game. Liverpool raced into an early 2-0 lead. The Spanish side drew level before half-time, both goals coming from Antoine Griezmann. Now, he was later controversially sent off. Unhappy Atletico were also denied a penalty by VAR, while at the other end, Mo Salah converted a penalty to ensure Liverpool stay top of Group B, where Porto beat Milan 1-0 in the other game. But after that defeat to Liverpool, this was the reaction of Atletico's England international defender, Kieran Trippier.
I thought we started the game slow. Liverpool went 2-0 up, but we've shown great character to come back into the game 2-2. So, yeah, some massive decisions in the game today, but, you know, no excuses. I feel like we still play very well with 10 men against an excellent side.
Penalties? Particularly the one that wasn't given to you, obviously.
Yeah, it's difficult from my angle because I was so far away, but the players say there was contact on Jose and the referee gave the penalty. Then he went to the screen and then he said no penalty. So, but like I said, the referee made his decision. There's no excuses. Liverpool are an unbelievable side. You see how they've been performing this season. We put in a good performance. We defended very well, created chances. And then even with 10 men, I thought defensively we was, you know, was in a good block. And we had good chances as well for like 30 minutes plus. So, no, like I said before, a lot of positives to take from the game, but disappointed we didn't at least come away with a draw.
In Group A, teenager Cole Palmer scored a classy goal and Riyad Mahrez scored twice as Manchester City recorded a very easy 5-1 win in Bruges. City remain a point behind Paris Saint-Germain in the group. The French side beat Leipzig 3-2 with Lionel Messi scoring twice. Borussia Dortmund's perfect start in Group C went up in smoke. They lost 4-0 to Ajax in Amsterdam. Sporting Lisbon beat Besiktas 4-1. And in Group D, Real Madrid back on top. They won 5-0 at Shakhtar Donetsk, while Sheriff lost 3-1 to Inter Milan. Later today, Manchester United play Atalanta, Chelsea meet Malmo. In the Europa League, Celtic had their first win. They beat Ferencváros 2-0. Furuhashi and Turnbull got the goals. They should have had a few more. In Dublin, spat between Bohemians and Shamrock Rovers continues. Bose have confirmed they will make no tickets available for away supporters for next month's derby clash with Rovers, despite the fact that sporting venues will be allowed to operate at 100% capacity then. With attendances at 50% under COVID-19 measures, Shamrock Rovers restricted ticket sales to home supporters only for Monday's clash between the sides. A statement from Bose last night claimed the club was disappointed by Rovers' decision and confirmed they will not allow Rovers supporters attend the clash at Dalymount on November the 12th. Now cricket, and the Irish men's team play their second game of the T20 World Cup in Abu Dhabi today. They play Sri Lanka, hoping to build on their impressive win over the Netherlands on Monday. Here's Irish coach Graham Ford.
Sri Lanka, probably about half the squad I know pretty well, and I know the coach very well. We know they're going to be a very competitive, energetic unit. They have had great success in this format in previous years and in previous T20 World Cups. So it'll be a huge game for us, but I think a really exciting challenge. We've played really a lot of emphasis on really trying to get out and enjoy it.
And that starts at 3 o'clock. Now, in Gaelic games, a growing and significant number of counties appear to be backing Proposal B for the GAA's special congress in Croke Park next Saturday. This effectively sees the league become the championship. Cork last night decided to support the proposal, joining fellow Munster counties Clare and Tipperary in doing so. And in Leinster, it's reported that Kildare, Meath and Longford will join Offaly, Westmeath and Louth in supporting it. Finally, Rachel, if you want a bit of action on your way home from Drogheda, you can pop across to Navan. Racing action is there today, and the first race is at 1:15.
Welcome back here to the Mill Enterprise Centre in Drogheda. Well, as we heard earlier, since the COVID pandemic began, there's been a shift in working patterns, with many people leaving bigger cities and returning to towns and villages where they can work remotely. Many others have decided to find a job closer to home in a bid to achieve a better work-life balance. Our North East correspondent Sinead Hussey has been to two villages in County Louth benefiting from the move back home.
This is where it all happened. So basically in this area, this is where all the solid wood timber starts.
O'Connor's in Drumleck is a bespoke furniture maker just outside of Castle Bellingham. It's a family business which was founded in 1988 and employs 25 people.
Basically here you can see where we, Sinead, we produce all our own countertops.
John O'Connor is the managing director, and he says he's noticed a shift in attitudes in the last 18 months or so, and people no longer want to make the commute to Dublin.
We would find a big drive since the COVID, both for people and younger people to have a better work-life balance. I think a lot of people who are doing the daily commute to the city who are working from home for a while have now realised that to have opportunities on their own doorstep has been a big win-win for them. Literally, we would see a lot of our staff would be within 15-20 minute radius of the workshop here. So I think they've all gained a much better work-life balance.
At O'Connor's, our recruitment drive is now underway. They're expanding rapidly and are hoping to attract people back to this area.
I suppose we're one of the best kept secrets in County Louth. Traditionally, in an organisation like this, it would be generally some cabinet makers and maybe one or two office admin. In our organisation today, we have a wide range of different roles and disciplines, right from sales to project management, design on the factory floor itself with the cabinet makers, wood polishing, and now we've introduced stone fabrication into the company. So there's a wide range of opportunities.
Aoife Reynolds is a junior designer at the company. She lives in Howth in Dublin, but is going to make the move to County Louth.
I used to work in Dublin City. I was looking for a design job, so the opportunity came up to work with O'Connor's, and eventually the plan is to move out of Dublin and to move up here. And the lifestyle is just really nice up here. It's much, I suppose, more relaxed and not as hectic, and I actually prefer it up here.
Nearby in Blackrock Village, remote working has led to a boom in business. At the Rock Salt Cafe, it's busier than ever. Daniel McLaughlin is the owner.
It's been amazing for the whole area here in Blackrock. There's been a lot of people who would have spent hours commuting up and down to Dublin every day, really, who have now stayed around the village or remote working from home. There's also been a lot more people in the village over the last, I suppose, year to 18 months that have made the choice and moved outside of the city and have come down now and are enjoying life in the village here, and it's fantastic to see. And I think the benefits for the whole area, the whole community, is fantastic. It's certainly benefited our business. We've a nice, lovely, steady flow pretty much Monday to Thursday, and then Friday, Saturday, Sunday it kind of takes off again, you know. But normally lunchtime and the hatch keeps going all day for coffees and takeaway food and stuff, and it's been great. During the various different lockdowns, the community here has really supported us and helped us continue trading and help the team stay in jobs, and it's been fantastic.
Of course, there's now more demand for housing, which in turn has led to price increases higher than the national average. Brian Carroll is from Sherry Fitzgerald in Dundalk.
Price inflation in the local area, based on the Sherry Fitzgerald House Price Index, nationally, is running at about 7% increase over for the first 9 months of 2021. In the Louth and Mid East area here, we're seeing prices slightly running ahead of that. And that's evident due to the shift in people out of the city centre areas. Inquiries at the moment, we're experiencing inquiries from the Greater Dublin area, from the UK, mainland Europe and further afield, Dubai. People relocating home, realising that work from home is an option. They were looking previously at three-bed semi-detached homes for the most part. Now four beds and four-bed three-storey homes are a big option for these people, for these buyers. The working from home is probably driving the house choice by these families to ensure that they can have a whole new lifestyle when they're stepping out of the city environment.
And that was Brian Carroll, who's an auctioneer in Dundalk in County Louth, ending that report from our northeast correspondent Sinead Hussey.
The skeletal remains of six people have been uncovered during an archaeological dig in Cork City. The remains were found under Nancy Spain's pub on Barrack Street. Ciara Brett is archaeologist at Cork City Council and is on the line now. Ciara, why was the dig going on?
Well, good morning, Audrey. The site is an important regeneration project for Cork City Council. So we are constructing 32-unit social housing development on the site. So MMD Construction are on the site on our behalf. And the site is located within the former suburbs of the medieval city of Cork, and it is of important historical and archaeological significance. So all the groundworks at the site were considered to be important. So I instructed as city archaeologists that they be archaeologically monitored when construction is going on. So that's why the archaeologists were on site.
So what was found, Ciara?
So effectively, on Thursday the 7th of October last, we discovered the remains of one individual. And as a consequence of that, we have had an archaeological excavation going on the site. So we have a licensed archaeologist, but we also have an osteoarchaeologist on the site. And in the last week or so, on top of that initial one skeleton, we've discovered five more individuals on the site. Now, the remains are quite fragmentary, and it's very early days in the archaeological investigation, and it's not possible to maybe definitively date them, but they certainly predate the 19th century buildings on the site. So I think they're possibly likely 18th century or earlier.
Wow. And what was on that site well before the pub was there?
Well, there were gardens to the rear, basically from... We can see from cartographic sources, from John Roke's maps from 1750s and an earlier map from 1726, that there were structures on the site and there were large garden areas to the rear. So, and further up the street, about 500 metres away from the site we're at now, there's the site of a 17th century gallows. And again, and 200 metres away from the site, we have Elizabeth Fort, which is a 17th century fort. So there's quite a lot of... later medieval material in the area. So it's quite a historic area.
Absolutely. Are you excited by this find, Ciara?
Oh yeah, we're very excited. Like it's not uncommon to find human remains within an urban context, but it's not an everyday occurrence, shall we say. So no, we're very excited. I suppose we're excited to get the remains off the site and to get them further analysed by the osteoarchaeologist, and also we hope to date the bones by radiocarbon dating. So at the moment we have no datable evidence, as in we've no artefacts associated with the skeletal remains, so we really do need to try and date them by radiocarbon dating.
Okay, so that's next on the agenda then?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And where are they at the moment?
Oh, they're still in the ground. They're still being excavated. The site is still under investigation. So we hope that we'll be done by the end of the week. So after that, as kind of best practice in these kind of things, they're all removed from the site. And obviously, they'll be examined by the osteoarchaeologist. She kind of does visual inspections. So she can identify quite a lot of things, such as the sex of the individuals, possible age of them, whether they're adult or juvenile. And she can sometimes also identify various diseases and possibly the manner in which they died as well.
Okay, fascinating.
So there's quite a lot of information to come out of it yet.
Absolutely. Well, the best of luck to you all. Thank you very much. Ciara Brett, archaeologist at Cork City Council.
As we heard in Sinead's report earlier, the world of work and business has changed considerably since the onset of COVID. Concepts like remote working that were largely in the trial stage in early 2020 are now part of our everyday working lives. And the location we're broadcasting from today is in many ways a reflection of that rapid change. I'm joined by two business people who work from the Mill Enterprise Hub, and also by Ronan Whitty, who's Director of Business Innovation and Enterprise here. And Ronan, the Mill has been here for about 7 years now. Has the pandemic changed the dynamic? I know it's grown quite considerably in those years, but is there more of a demand for a centre like this?
Well, I think there is. I think, you know, you see the growth in remote working. I think people have got more comfortable working from home. Drogheda has long had a trend of people moving from Drogheda to Dublin, be it the PAYE worker or also the employed person who has their own business in Dublin but living in Drogheda. And here at the Mill, like, obviously we offer a facility here where they can, you know, look to set up their own business and run their business from Drogheda.
Well, let's hear from one of those businesses here, Yvonne Brady of EVB Sports. You're an engineer by training, Yvonne, but what you've developed with your engineering skills is quite astounding and has been helpful to many.
Yes, indeed. I'm an engineer by trade, and what we're essentially doing, we're working in pelvic health now, and essentially it's an engineering company where we design and manufacture support garments. And essentially what we do externally in a conservative way is what the surgeons have been doing for many years.
You've international operations. How has the pandemic changed the world of work for you and your staff?
Zoom has been great, naturally. We have 2 full-time staff and 4 part-time staff, and then we have a design house in Portugal, and then our e-commerce site is e-commerce support team are over in Spain. In the past, I would have to have gone and spent perhaps a week over in Portugal. So in terms of time efficiency, Zoom has been wonderful to be able to talk to the team more efficiently in that regards. But it has its limitations. And when you're trying to grow in an international company, in a sense, it's important to get the strong team around you. So the Mill has enabled us to actually, you know, with its large meeting rooms and stuff, enable the board to come here. And the creative process that comes from people actually working together has been wonderful for us.
And you manufacture sports clothing, essentially. We've heard a lot about material shortage in the last while since the pandemic and as we're coming out of it. Has that been your experience?
Yes, this year has been difficult, although we're on track to double our sales this year. But it has forced us to actually rethink our in terms of our stock demand, you know, actually order more stock, which have put constraints and cash flow constraints on the business, in essence, the raw materials have been a bit of a disaster in terms of in that situation.
Shane Monaghan is founder and CEO of Lemur, which is a podcasting platform with a bit of a twist. I'll let you describe it, Shane.
Yeah, so Lemur, it's a new social audio platform that makes the process of podcasting production and distribution easy, instant and interactive. And with Lemur, you can record, edit and share your voice and podcast straight from your phone, talking directly with your followers in the voice comment section, which helps you to spark real conversation.
Drogheda, being on the M1 corridor, has apparently developed quite a tech startup scene. Has that been your experience, and have there been good supports in that regard?
Yeah, no, I see the future of the Drogheda area in particular as something of a potential Irish Silicon Valley. I'm a bit biased because I'm from the area anyway, but there's fantastic talent here, and the supports in particular here in the Mill has been absolutely fantastic for me, especially when things start to open up again.
Well, Ronan, Shane and Yvonne, thank you for joining us here.
The confusion surrounding how the reopening of nightclubs and other hospitality venues will work following yesterday's announcement regarding the limited lifting of restrictions receives extensive coverage in this morning's papers. A full reopening with restrictions is the new normal, says Varadkar, but nighttime industry attacks chaotic guidelines. That's a headline on the front of the Irish Daily Mail. The Irish Daily Star and Irish Sun opt for the light-hearted headlines, copper face masks and party on, but both papers report on the widespread confusion caused by the new rules. The Star observes how people can dance in nightclubs but not in pubs, while the Sun draws attention to the fact that the government gave the okay to mask-free dancing in clubs, yet banned queuing at the bar for a drink. Under the headline, Nights of Chaos Ahead, the lead story in the Irish Examiner quotes Cork pub owner Ger Kiley saying that the requirement that all gigs must be seated will halve the capacity at gigs in his venues, many of which have already been sold at full capacity. The decision, meanwhile, that sports stadiums can be filled to capacity generates the lead headline in the Irish Daily Mirror. The Irish Independent is more considered in its response to yesterday's announcement. Long winter of COVID rules despite our new freedoms is the headline on its front page, while its lead editorial asserts that our health officials and political leaders do not glory in these sanctions, but have chosen them as the best possible route forward. For its lead story, meanwhile, the Irish Times details how the rollout of booster vaccines to the over 60s is due to start in November. Elsewhere on the front pages, the Irish News leads with the line that former RUC officer Brian Coulter, who was found dead at a house in Maher of Felt in County Derry on Monday, had been convicted of the sectarian abuse of his neighbours 5 years ago. Another killing, that of 23-year-old Jake Bailey Sloan, who died in hospital on Monday after being assaulted in Portadown in County Armagh on Sunday, is covered on the front of today's Belfast Telegraph. Police officers have arrested a man in his 20s and are treating the incident as a murder investigation. The Independent gives front page coverage this morning to a study conducted by UCC's School of Medicine, which is critical of how concussion is dealt with during inter-county hurling matches. There's a story in the front of the Times about a legal action which University of Limerick is taking against Irish Water over a move to impose water charges on college residences. A number of today's papers carry pictures from the animal rights protest outside government buildings yesterday, protesting at a recent deal to export live pigs to China. Campaigners dressed up as the Three Little Pigs and an air hostess holding a life-size model pig in a cargo crate bound for China. The Independent reports this morning on the 3-month jail sentence and 1-year driving ban imposed on Stephen McGee from Baldoyle in North Dublin for impersonating a Gartha with flashing blue lights on his car. The 45-year-old police memorabilia collector was caught when he mistakenly pulled over plainclothes Gardaí. And finally, there's a nice story in today's Examiner about how Damien Coughlin from Rathcormac in County Cork made an unexpected discovery on a visit to an exhibition on the 1,200 IRA volunteers who were imprisoned on Spike Island during the War of Independence in 1921. While he was leafing through some of the exhibition's artefacts, Damien came across a poem written by his great-grandfather, Pat Coughlin. Nobody in the family ever knew that Pat had been on Spike Island since he never spoke about it. And on hearing Damien's story, management at the facility presented him with a book of the exhibition, which Deputy General Manager Tom O'Neill spent a decade researching and which brought to light more information which the Coughlin family had never known about their great-grandfather.
Just under 2,400 cases of COVID-19 were reported yesterday. On the same day, the government announced that the economy will fully reopen on Friday. Masks will still have to be worn, and any indoor events, including in restaurants, bars and nightclubs, will only be open to vaccinated people. Live music venues and theatres can be seated only. Latest figures show 13 intensive care beds available across the country. 473 people are in hospital with COVID. 74 of them are in intensive care. We are joined now by Dr. Coleman O'Loughlin, who is president of the Intensive Care Society of Ireland. Dr. O'Loughlin, good morning. You're welcome.
Good morning, Audrey.
Can ICU cope at the moment?
Yes, I think that's a simple answer. At the moment, the numbers are increasing, but as things stand, we're able to cope with the numbers coming through from the emergency departments into the wards and into the ICU, and at the same time cope with non-COVID activity in the hospital. But I suppose our concerns arise around the projections. And the projections that were talked about a lot yesterday were up to 1,000 patients in hospital and 150 in ICU over the next couple of weeks and months. And that is quite concerning because that's going to be very difficult to cope with in the setting of this very, increased capacity across the, or increased activity across all hospital levels that's been going on over many months. So we're looking at a situation where you said 74 beds today. This day last year, there was 34 beds. So we're going into this not in the best position. We're talking about a cohort of patients that when they come into the intensive care are very, very, very sick and stay a very, very long time. Not all of them will survive, and those who do survive are very unwell for a significant period afterwards. So it's a huge challenge, and one that I suppose we'd hoped we wouldn't have to face into again, but the numbers are there and it's happening. Transmission in the community is much higher than we'd like, and that will, and it always has done. That relationship between high transmission in the community relating into hospital admissions and into ICU has always been there, and that's going to happen. There's no getting away from that.
And even if the numbers don't rise to the levels projected yesterday, which you referred to yesterday, how high can they go without the system getting into serious trouble?
I mean, it's very difficult because it's very difficult to project that type of scenario. Each time we face into this, the society is different. The first time we had complete lockdown, hospitals were empty, apart from COVID activity. The second wave we had after Christmas, there was very little vaccination happening. So the environment we were operating in was very different. What's concerning at the moment, I suppose, is that just general hospital activity is extremely, extremely busy. I mean, RED over the summer has seen attendances higher than it's ever seen for months and months in a row, which it's never seen before, and this is during the summer. So that's kind of leading to a kind of very tight system, and we're trying to figure out how we can squeeze in emergency care alongside all this COVID work as well. I don't have an answer for that, what that number is. Each hospital will have a different point at which it will have to kind of consider how it runs as a hospital in terms of coping with increased COVID activity. I suppose the word that's used a lot is the surge activation. So each hospital is different in that aspect, but it's a place no one wants to get to. Surge is something that we really, really, really want to avoid.
Well, I was going to say, no one's using surge yet, are they?
No, not in the classic sense. There are ICUs that have had to change the way they work. Not every ICU is the same. Some will have divided up into two different ICUs, one for COVID and one for non-COVID. As an example of a difference, and that is the ICU in the Mater, where we have single rooms and we have COVID alongside non-COVID in the same ICU. So in the classic sense, surge hasn't been activated. And it's something, as I said, that we're really, really nervous about because, and it's not maybe that well appreciated nationally, that surge isn't something that just exists. There's no great cavalry around the corner that you can call on to make this happen. As a colleague of mine said, that to surge in ICU, you have to de-surge somewhere else in the hospital. So you have to close aspects of the hospital, ask those staff to move across into an area they're not familiar with, and look after very, very sick patients. And as I said, the hospital is so busy anyway, no one can identify any areas in the hospital that you can do that easily to. And again, it looks like, again, that if it does happen, it'll be elective surgery that'll probably take the biggest brunt. And we're talking about an environment of phenomenal waiting lists and huge amount of numbers that's been well publicised on waiting lists. So, the last thing we want to do is add to those waiting lists by deferring elective surgery again. But that's the kind of the low-hanging fruit and how we do activate surgery. So it's something we're really, really, really reluctant to do.
Yeah.
But if we have to, we will.
It's probably not helpful for me to say that perhaps at any point over the past 20 years, we could have said there are only 13 ICU beds available around the country and the system didn't collapse. But is this different? Are you operating in a different league at this point?
I think so. I mean, it's a very complex system, how the ICU works and what's available. For example, the ICU in the Mater is full at the moment, but yet we have patients who will move into ICU to see other patients move out, so that the beds don't get cold. I mean, they've been turned around all the time, but it's hard to describe what an available ICU bed is all the time. Most ICUs don't have empty beds. They don't have a bed waiting for a patient to come in. What they will have is someone on the far side of an illness and are getting towards being suitable for ward transfer, and then when the next sick patient comes, that that transfer happens. So that kind of level of oversight into ICUs is very difficult to get. But we've always operated on, you know, a capacity problem where we're occupancy in ICU has been over 100% in a lot of the big ICUs in the hospital for many, many years. And that's been advertised, it's been brought to the attention of the HSE for many years. And they're aware of that, and I suppose, you know, plans are afoot to try and increase ICU capacity. But unfortunately, and I think people will appreciate that this, it doesn't happen that easily. You need real estate, you need new builds, you need new areas to put those ICU beds in, because every nook and cranny of every hospital is being utilised now. There's no space to put that. So that requires all those problems of design and tender and planning permission and building, and all that takes time. So it is a difficult process, and we are operating, I suppose, at a level that we've never operated before in terms of asking our staff to, you know, push the boat out even further than they have done for many years. We're operating in huge levels of overtime, huge amount of goodwill, which is thankfully still there, but it's very different than what we're used to.
Yeah, and just under 2,400 cases of COVID announced yesterday. Why do you think the cases are rising?
Look, I think, you know, it's disheartening to see that. I think that applies to everybody, not just us working in the hospital sector. I mean, I'm not entirely sure. I'm not a public health desk expert, but I think the hope was that if we had a certain amount of population vaccinated, that we would have two things would happen. One, we would be able to offer those people vaccinated a significant level of protection. I think that's very, very true. Nearly all our patients in ICU are unvaccinated at the moment. So that concept of offering a huge amount of protection has happened from the vaccine. What doesn't seem to have happened to that same level is the reduction in transmission. So we seem to be able to protect people. This vaccine doesn't seem to have the same level of effectiveness in reducing virus transmission in the community. So therefore, it is circulating much higher than we thought we would be with such a high level of vaccination in the community. And there's a lot of people who are still unvaccinated. There's somewhere between 250,000 people still unvaccinated and who are at the exact same risk and the exact same vulnerability levels as they were in March 2020. So, you know, a lot of things have changed, but that problem with transmission hasn't changed. That's a concern, because unfortunately we know the only way that we've been able to reduce transmission in the past has been increasing social distancing, increasing mm-hmm. those measures, which no one wants to go back to.
Yeah, and it was interesting, Dr. Killian de Gascon tweeting over the past number of days that when it comes to transmission, vaccinated people can transmit the infection at the exact same viral load as an unvaccinated person, which I thought was very interesting and surprising to me.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, I think what it does is offers, and I can't overemphasize that the level of protection it offers the vast majority of people is huge. As I said, we have 9 people in our unit at the moment. 5 are in the intensive care per se and 4 in the HDU. But the 5 in the intensive care who are the sickest, none of those have been vaccinated. So the protection level is extraordinary, and it's extremely valuable. But yes, you're able to, get the virus into your system, into your kind of upper airway tract, and the virus can replicate and it can transmit if you cough or sneeze. And that's becoming more evident. There's a lot of work being done on nasal vaccines, and I think that's going to be very important in the future, that we'll probably get intramuscular and nasal vaccines to help with the transmission element of it. But at the moment, yes, that's becoming a concern. And to me, who I'm not an expert in this area, it appears that is the major flaw so far. A flaw is a strong word, but it's a major downside to the vaccination programs. We're not seeing that reduction in transmission that we would have hoped to have seen.
All right. Well, very good to talk to you this morning, and good luck to you all. Thank you very much, Dr. Coleman O'Loughlin, President of the Intensive Care Society of Ireland.
Well, for the rest of the week on Morning Ireland, we'll be on the road finding out how towns and cities around the country are coping with the slow emergence from COVID restrictions. But as we heard there, the renewed rise in infections is placing a strain on hospitals. This morning, we're in Drogheda at the Mill Enterprise Hub. If you put your ear right up against the radio, you can probably hear coffee being made in the background. Last night, our reporter Una Kelly asked people in the town of Drogheda for their reaction to the further partial loosening of restrictions.
To be honest, I think the restrictions are kind of, they've always been a bit of a half measure, because a lot of people, especially what I've observed, is most of them tend not to adhere that strongly to them.
Yeah, to me, people are not following the restrictions as is, so the reducing the restrictions doesn't really seem to matter, because no one's following them anyway.
If you went out to a bar or restaurant, for example, you'll still have to wear a mask when you're not seated. There will be table service. You'll have to show COVID certs. What do you think about that? Are you happy about that or not?
I don't really mind. It's normality at this stage.
It's only a minor inconvenience.
Yeah. I don't really mind about wearing the masks. The COVID, I'm literally only after coming back from Liverpool at the weekend, and I had to go through immigration and the whole lot there, and I wasn't even asked for any COVID certs.
I'll be okay with everything. I think, like, you know, is that, like, we in this for 2 years now, in that stage, like, you know, I think it's finally the time for to ease up now the restrictions, and, like, you know, the companies and all the industry just suffer so much, like, you know, and they have to reopen eventually, like.
Well, personally, I'd avoid crowds, regardless of what the regulations are.
Do you still feel quite cautious?
Yeah, you'd have to be. I think they're never going to let us out, to tell you the truth. They're never going to be finished. They're going to go on forever.
There won't be caps on outdoor sporting events, no limits of people to weddings or religious events.
Big deal. Big deal. I think this whole thing is a scam from day one, to be honest with you.
Do you mind me asking? You don't have to answer, but did you get vaccinated?
I did, yeah. I was coerced into it. I felt I was coerced into getting vaccinated. But I'll tell you what, I will not be getting any boosters. That's it now with the vaccinations. Okay. That's it now.
What do you mean you were coerced? Why do you think vaccines aren't a good idea?
Pressure. I personally don't believe in them. And I lived this long and I never had any need for vaccines.
I suppose fewer people are dying because more people are vaccinated, though.
But are they?
Yeah, they are. That's a fact.
Is it a fact?
I'm 20 years old.
So you've missed 2 years nearly of nightclubs?
Yeah, 2 years. Like, it didn't really do the head good, like, just in the house all the time either. Like, so I think, like, getting back to some sort of normality, you know, you'd be surprised, like, it could do you. Yeah. You know, people at our age, the world are good.
Hopefully he'll enjoy his weekend. Una Kelly talking to people here in Drogheda last night. Joining us now is Mark McGowan, who owns Scholars Townhouse Hotel and Peggy Moore's Pub in Drogheda. He's also the president of the Restaurant Associations of Ireland. Thanks for being with us. Let's talk about what was announced yesterday. We've already heard several calls for clarity on the programme this morning. Are you clear about what will be changing on Friday?
Yes, clarity seems to be the term is that we've been looking for the last 20 months, Rachel. So again, it's the 11th hour and we haven't received our full guidelines yet. So my business is a hotel, restaurant and bar. And the fact that we're heading into a Christmas period now, it's a critical time of year for us and we still are unsure what's happening in terms of multiple table numbers. We know that the table numbers have gone from a 6 to a 10, but that doesn't really help in terms of multiple tables. We can already receive coach tours, believe it or not, so I can serve Christmas parties if everybody decides to say that they're part of a coach tour.
Isn't this all very complicated, though? I mean, the government would point out that they only got the advice from NPHET late on Monday evening and that really they had to move very quickly. So presumably over the coming days, you'll be able to find out more.
We're hoping that the guidelines will be given to us sooner rather than later because there's a lot of decisions that have to be made. We have to plan rosters, we have to plan the logistics of our table plans in the restaurants, etc. So, and we may have to hire more staff as well. The fact that the COVID certs are here to stay, which I actually welcome, I think that it is an additional labour cost, but what it does is mitigate risk. And I think that's ultimately what this is all about.
As you mentioned the COVID certs, one issue that has emerged over the past few days is that too many restaurants and bars aren't asking for vaccine certs, or if they are asking, they're doing it in a kind of half-hearted way. Would you accept that that is a problem?
I'd be disappointed if it happened within my own business. I'm hoping it doesn't happen whatsoever. I'm on the ground most of the time and most of my staff are fairly diligent in how they ask for certs.
Would you accept, though, that not everybody is diligent?
I can't answer that question. What I've heard on the ground is that the majority of people are compliant. I've been around the country myself and most of our members have been compliant.
Would you welcome greater enforcement, though? Because after all, that would give people more confidence.
Absolutely. I think it's very important. We have a responsibility as business owners to make sure that we follow through, make sure that all businesses are compliant, our staff are being compliant. That way we're keeping our staff safe, we're keeping customers safe, and that's the way I'm trying to run my business anyway.
Just one final question on business. Obviously, people in your own line of work, you've had a very difficult time over the past 18, 19 months. Has business now bounced back?
Business has bounced back for myself and Drogheda anyway. We've had a really good summer. Outdoor dining, everybody seemed to really take it on. Now, we did have a very good summer as well. Peggy Murrays is coming back slowly. Until the restrictions are totally eased within the likes of a pub environment and we can get that ambience back, people sitting at bar counters, that's the fabric of a pub, is that social
aspect. Do you accept,
aspect?
Though, that for now that might just be too risky?
I think if living with COVID, I think we've been so compliant. If everybody is vaccinated and the staff are doing their job at the door, well, then I think that there should be a full relaxation indoors while we're serving.
Mark McGowan, thank you very much for joining us here at the Mill.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. Discover our 2-to-1 offers at your local Kia dealer. For more, log on to kia.com.
And at 8:37, it's good morning again to Des.
Yeah, hi Audrey. Well, a growing number of counties appear to be backing Proposal B for the GAA's special congress in Croke Park next Saturday. This effectively sees a massive change, the league becoming the championship. Cork last night decided to support the proposal. They'll be joining other Munster counties, Clare and Tipperary, in doing so. In Leinster, it's reported Kildare, Meath and Longford will join Offaly, Westmeath and Louth in definitely supporting it. Other counties waiting to see how things go, but there does seem to be a swing now towards it. In soccer, there was great drama in the Champions League. Mo Salah scored twice for Liverpool. They had a real roller coaster 3-2 win away to Atletico Madrid. Liverpool raced into an early 2-0 lead, but the Spanish side drew level before half time, both goals coming from Antoine Griezmann. He was later controversially sent off, and Salah converted a penalty to ensure Liverpool stay top of Group B, where Porto beat AC Milan 1-0. But apart from the sending off, Atletico were denied a penalty by VAR. And the Liverpool manager, Jurgen Klopp, accepted some of the decisions may have been hard to take for the Spanish side.
Of course, I understand that Atletico people or Spanish people are upset or don't like the decisions. But I think the first, our penalty, the penalty we conceded, is a clear penalty. The penalty for Atletico, in my understanding, is not a penalty. But when he whistles it, I was a bit surprised that they took it back because I only saw it once and I didn't think it was a penalty. It was clear what they wanted in that moment. And the red card, you know, of course it's unlucky, but I think it's a red card. Can I change that? The foot is in the face. That's what you get red cards for. So that's not cool, but it happened. And yeah, that's the story of the game pretty much. We still had to defend with all we have because even with 10 men, they were quite intense to play. But the dirty 3 points are very often the most important, and they were dirty tonight, of course. It was not our best football, but we got them, and that's a big step.
In Group A, teenager Cole Palmer scored a classy goal and Riyad Mahrez scored twice as Manchester City had an easy 5-1 win in Bruges. City remain a point behind Paris Saint-Germain in the group. The French side beat Leipzig 3-2 with Lionel Messi scoring twice. Borussia Dortmund's perfect start in Group C went up in smoke. They lost 4-0 to Ajax in Amsterdam, while Sporting Lisbon beat Besiktas 4-1. In Group D, Real Madrid go top on scoring difference. They won 5-0 at Shakhtar Donetsk, while Sheriff lost 3-1 to Inter Milan. Later today, Manchester United play Atalanta and Chelsea meet Malmo. In the Europa League, Celtic had their first win. They beat Ferencvaros 2-0. Furuhashi and Turnbull got the goals. They should have had a couple more. At home, Bohemians have confirmed they will make no tickets available for away supporters for next month's Dublin Derby clash with Shamrock Rovers, despite the fact that sporting venues will be allowed to operate at 100% capacity then. With attendances at 50% under COVID-19 measures, Rovers restricted ticket sales to home supporters only from Monday's clash between the sides. And a statement from Bohemians last night said the club was disappointed by Rovers' decision and confirmed they will not allow Rovers supporters to attend the clash at Dalymount on the 12th of November. Now, the Irish men's cricket team play their second game of the T20 World Cup in Abu Dhabi today. They play Sri Lanka, hoping to build on their impressive win over the Netherlands on Monday. And after that victory, Irish captain Andrew Balbirnie discussed the playing conditions in Abu Dhabi.
Yeah, I think naturally there's been a lot of cricket here in all three grounds here, a ridiculous amount of cricket. The IPL's just finished, so we looked a lot at the scores there and the dimensions in those games and spoke to a couple of guys in the IPL that we knew just about particular small little things about the ground. But yeah, you're right, we played five games here in January, albeit one day cricket, but their grounds we know pretty well, and it worked today. I thought, like I said, we were brilliant with the ball and set good strong fields, and were aware of the dimensions and where not to bowl and where to bowl, and similar with our hitting. So yeah, it all kind of came into place. Like I said, I think we're slowly getting exactly to where we want. This is a great start, but that's all it is. We reiterated that message inside that it's a brilliant win, but it's only one win, and if you're guaranteed of going through, you need three of them. So hopefully we can get another one in a couple of days' time.
Yeah, good luck to Ireland in that match. Now, it won't be quite Abu Dhabi weather conditions, Rachel, but racing today is at Navan and the first race is off at 1:15.
Dhabi around here this morning. Let's get more now on the plans for a further partial loosening of COVID restrictions. Joining us on the line is the Agriculture Minister, Charlie McConnellow. Good morning.
Good morning, Rachel.
Given the level of confusion and disagreement about the latest reopening plans, do you accept that the announcement could have been better handled?
No, I think it's important, first of all, to note, Rachel, where we're at, and it's a welcome moment which many of us and people right across society have been looking forward to for a long time, and that with the remaining aspects of hospitality, entertainment and the nighttime economy after 18 months being able to open on Friday. So, listen, this was a decision which obviously has been considered carefully. As we know, in the last 2 or 3 weeks, there had been a deterioration in infection rates, and that had to be considered by NPHET. We received the advice from NPHET then on Monday evening, and the Cabinet met yesterday. And we made that decision yesterday, that considered decision, to proceed with the full reopening, but with protective measures still being in place.
Isn't it a bit late, though, to be consulting people like those who own and run nightclubs or other venues when the changes are due to be introduced on Friday, the day after tomorrow?
Well, I think it's important to recognise that, you know, we are reopening after 18 months, and for the last 18 months, all of these venues have been closed. The first part of the decision, Rachel, is actually making the decision that we can proceed up until yesterday. That hadn't been decided. Of course, the intention back in early September was that would, you know, that if the infection rates had stayed low, that we'd be able to go fully open. But it is clear that we're going to have as many restrictions and protective measures in place. So that does, now that we've made the decision, require further engagement with each sector to ensure.
And will
that
you be doing that over the next 2 days? Because
we will,
it's clear that people are confused, and some of them are fairly put out.
Yeah, and we will bring clarity to that. But I mean, as we've all come to learn over the last number of months, it is complicated and challenging in relation to the reopening. There is details involved that are specific to each sector, and that does require engagement with each sector once a decision is made in terms of how we're proceeding. So that will be happening today and tomorrow in terms of clarifying that. Then going forward, it's going to be important that, you know, in terms of our personal lives, obviously, and also in terms of each business that every effort is made to ensure that we do have the protective measures to minimise the risk of transmission.
Given that, are there specific plans now to ensure greater enforcement of the use of vaccination certificates?
Well, the HSE have been conducted several thousand checks in this regard, and that is something that will continue and indeed be increased in the time ahead.
So they will be conducting more of those checks?
Absolutely. And I think also in relation to, all of us having a personal responsibility in relation to ensuring that the businesses we're engaging with, I think by and large businesses have been really responsible in this regard, have taken their responsibilities very seriously to ensure that their setting is one that is as safe as it possibly can be, and indeed that the COVID certificates are checked on the way in. But there's a role for all of us as well in terms of how we engage with businesses, that we actually self-police this in our own way as well, alongside the work that the HSC will be doing. Because you know there is going to be an obligation on all of us as we deal with this continuing challenge in the weeks and months ahead to continue to be responsible in our daily lives. While thankfully we are getting back to the situation where we're turning to a more normal life, that we do be cautious and take precautions as we go about that life.
Talking of personal decisions, 370,000 people are either unvaccinated or only partially vaccinated. Do you accept that at this stage you're unlikely to reach many more of them, that they've made up their minds and they don't want to be vaccinated?
Well, I think we need to continue with the message. And obviously, you know, it has been well documented at this stage that, you know, while it's just 10% of the population that are unvaccinated, they're making up over half of those who are in hospital and indeed up to 2/3 of those who are in intensive care. So we have to continue getting that message across. And indeed, it is gradually improving, but only marginally so. But I think we do have to emphasize to everyone the contribution they can make to those around them, as well as to their own safety by getting vaccinated. There's continuing efforts as well in relation to, for example, as the third level colleges had opened up, making it as easy as possible for people to access vaccines. And we'll continue that approach as well in every way possible. Of course,
access to vaccines, you announced yesterday that there is going to be this wider rollout of the booster vaccine, the third vaccine for those over 60. When is this likely to start and will people be contacted? Will this happen automatically?
Yes, this will be. We made the decision yesterday for those between 60 and 80 that a booster vaccine will be provided to them. So the HSE will be putting in place arrangements now to follow through in terms of how that happens. Obviously, thankfully, we've had a very efficient rollout of the vaccination process up until now. About 100,000 people have already received boosters, those aged over 80, as well as people in residential care over the age of 65. So the next step now is in terms of providing that booster vaccination to those between 60 to 80. So that's something the HSE will now be engaging and moving forward with and engaging with people in terms of how that's administered. And I think given the tremendous job that has been done in relation to rolling out the vaccination programme so far, we can have confidence that the HSE will do that very efficiently.
NPHET was due to be disbanded around now. That was one of the changes that was due to happen this week. Is it safe to assume that that now isn't going to happen?
Yeah, well, there's currently isn't a plan for that. Obviously, it will depend on how the pandemic evolves. I think we all, 2 or 3 or 4 weeks ago, had been more optimistic about the few weeks and months ahead. As has happened in many instances over the last 18 months, it's clear, you know, that the pandemic has a mind of its own, and we have to work together to address the challenges they evolve. And certainly, you know, it's clear that there will be an increase in infections in the time ahead. And listen, in terms of working with NPHET and that public health advice, it is proven absolutely essential.
So NPHET is going to be there for the foreseeable future.
Well, we will continue to work with NPHET and public health the public health advisors for as long as is necessary to manage the very difficult challenge that we've had.
Just one other area to talk about this morning, and that's your own brief, agriculture. We're awaiting the announcement of the carbon budget, which is a key part of the government's plan to combat climate change. Do you expect much resistance from farmers?
No, I think right across society, everyone is aware of the fact that we all have to play a role in our lives and in our professions in the time ahead to meet that climate change challenge that is there. And that's also the case in relation to the production of agriculture and food. And indeed, our starting point is a very strong one there, because when you look across the various types of food, whether it be dairy or beef or horticulture and grain that we produce, we're one of the most sustainable producers in the world. So agriculture has proven its credentials in relation to being very sustainable domestically here. But of course, we have to continue to improve in that. And while we'll continue to produce that food,
huge improvements are needed, according to the experts. I mean, are you prepared to advocate a cut to the national herd?
Well, huge improvements are required in all walks of life, whether it be in relation to energy, in relation to transport, in relation to construction, or indeed in relation to agriculture and food. And certainly I will be working with farmers in relation to and primary producers in relation to ensuring that we make our contribution to that climate change challenge in the time ahead.
And if a cut to the national herd number was deemed to be advisable or indeed necessary, is that something you would be prepared to go with?
I think the key objective has to be to reduce the emissions footprint of the food that we produce. It's really important that we continue to reduce that food. We do it very sustainably. We're a world leader in relation to how we do it, but we have to continue to get even better at that. So it'll be about producing the food, Rachel, but also in parallel to that, taking every step we possibly can to reduce the emissions footprint of how it's produced. And I think farmers are very much are up for that. And indeed, in terms of the announcement I will be making with the Taoiseach this morning, in terms of our CAP strategic plan for the next 5 years, we will be financially backing farmers in relation to that as well, because I'm glad that with the support of the Minister for Public Expenditure, Michael McGrath, to be able to announce a 50% increase in terms of our national funding to the CAP strategic plan for the next 6 years up to the end of 2027, okay, to support farmers on that journey and to ensure that farm incomes are very much central over the time ahead, okay, in terms of as being the key priority of the government, and in terms of the support we'll be providing to agriculture to play its very significant role, along with the rest of society, in meeting the climate change challenge that we all must face together.
Right, as you say, more to be heard later in the day. Minister Charlie McConlogue, thank you for joining us. It's 8 minutes to 9. We'll have more from Drogheda after a quick break.
Better value. It lives at Dunn Stores, so enjoy spooktacular savings this Halloween. Mix and match any 5 for €5 across thrilling treats like snack-sized Kit Kat Chunky and Chickadee's multi-packs plus MyWaddy 1 litre range. And chilling freezer favourites like selected Goodfellas pizzas are only €2. Plus, with our 10/50 grocery voucher, you save even more. Which means every trip to Dunn Stores this Halloween means better value. Dunn Stores, always better value. Terms and conditions apply. Voucher can be used on next grocery shop of €50 or more.
For Irish companies starting their digital journey, Enterprise Ireland is here to help. From enhancing customer experience to improving your cybersecurity. With our €9,000 digitalisation voucher, you can engage an expert to develop a digital roadmap for your business. If you're a manufacturing or internationally traded services company employing 10 or more employees, apply on globalambition.ie/digital. Enterprise Ireland. If you have the ambition, we'll help you take it global. An initiative of the Government of Ireland.
Residential property owners, the deadline for submitting your local property tax return to Revenue is the 7th of November. Before submitting your return, you need to determine the market value of your property. The easiest way to submit your return is online at revenue.ie. If you need help, you can call Revenue on 01 738 3626. Don't miss the deadline. Submit your local property tax return by the 7th of November.
Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
Coming up on today's programme, dysfunctional dynasties, the TV families that we love to hate. We speak to Gesu Yuri about her life since fleeing Afghanistan, and Kathleen Murray is here to answer all of your canine queries. You can email us on todaycb@rte.ie and join us at 10.
And you're welcome back to Drogheda. The time is 8:54 and our northeast correspondent Sinead Hussey is here. Sinead, we heard you reporting earlier on the move to more home working, on people deciding to change their lives entirely and move to a different part of the country. I suppose an awful lot of people in this area and many others have had a hard time over the past 18 months. As you see it, what are the big challenges now facing the region?
Yeah, well, as you say, you know, from being out on the road over the last 18 months or so, you know, work has changed and life has changed for many people, or for everyone at this stage. If you're listening to the traffic news on this programme every morning, you'll always hear the N2, the N3, the M1 being mentioned. There's always traffic delays, there's backups. And this is a reality for many people living in this region. And we're not even gone back to full capacity yet. I was speaking to a man in RD this week who told me it took him 16 minutes to travel 70 yards the other day. And it's quicker for him to drive to Drogheda to do his shopping than go into RD, which is a 7-minute drive, or at least should be a 7-minute drive from his house. So there's major infrastructural needs. I know the N2 bypass in RD is part of the National Development Plan, but even if that were to start tomorrow, and that's not going to be the case, it's going to take a couple of years, you know, to get it built for people to be able to travel on. I think attitudes have changed, and I think people will not go back to that rat race, that sitting in traffic, leaving at 6 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the morning to get into Dublin. And I think that's where regional hubs like the one here in Drogheda, they're dotted all around this region, they're dotted all around the country. I think that's where they're really going to come into play. The broadband is there, and that's an issue for many people at home at the moment. They don't have good broadband, so working from home is a struggle, it's a challenge. The other thing, they can come in here, they can meet people. So that isolation that you have working remotely.
Because this is a thing that many people found over the past 18, 19 months. It can be very hard on the mental health staying at home, either on your own or with small children all the time.
Absolutely. If you're sitting in a room, you're looking at a computer screen, you're on Zoom calls, there's no socialisation, there's no interaction, there's no, you know, catching up with people. You just can't do it. And I think that's where these regional hubs will come in, because you can come in, meet other people, share ideas and make contacts. The other thing that I think people are looking at, and you'd have picked up on it in that report I did earlier, you know, this whole idea of a fixation with Dublin, having to go to Dublin to work, having to get a job in an accountancy firm in Dublin, and I'm just using that as an example. People now, I think, are looking, I live in Drogheda, could I get a job in Dundalk? Could I get a job in Navan? You know, a 25-minute drive as opposed to an hour and a half with lots of traffic. So I think that's definitely the change. And what that will do will be towns like Navan and Drogheda, where people left every morning at 6 o'clock, didn't return till 8 o'clock in the evening, you know, they'll begin to blossom. And we've heard that in that report, you know, these towns have been completely and utterly rejuvenated.
Well, that would be something to hope for. Sinead, thank you very much. That was our North East correspondent, Sinead Hussey. Tomorrow morning, by the way, Morning Ireland will be in Shannon, no better place. It's